we'll finish the Salah, which is the second of the three pillars of Islam. And if you go to page 2 and look at the bottom of the page, you'll see the times and the names of the prayers in Islam at the very bottom of the page. 5 times it says. Mm-hmm. So early morning is Fajr, and that's like Alot HaShachar. You know, if you studied Brachot, Masechet Brachot, it's the first rays of light come up, but the sun hasn't come up yet. That's the time of Fajr. And the noon is when the sun is exactly at the zenith. So the longest period of time between prayers in the system is between the earliest morning prayer and the noon prayer. Theoretically, you get some work done in between.
That's the time you can work, yes.
Yeah.
How do you know that it's, the sun is up there? Because it's very difficult.
Oh, well, in the desert climate of the Middle East, there's no shadow. That's the time when there would be no shadow. Because mm-hmm. the sun would be directly mm-hmm. above you.
Only in the prophets.
Okay.
Not in the Middle East.
Okay. But so it would be the narrowest shadow, the smallest shadow.
Yeah, but it's very difficult to then you only know in retrospect.
But it's from one day to the next. No.
Well, they do calculations now. It's all calculations. It's all times. We know when the sun will be at the top. We know when sunset is and when sunrise is. And that's all done. And there are...
Oh, is this roughly?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's roughly. And today, there is a kind of a new...
iPhone.
Yeah, I'm sure there are apps on the iPhone. And there are, you used to be able to buy clocks that have, like, all these different hands that were doing different things. I didn't never understood them, but I've seen them, where they tell you when the different ones are going to occur. Today there is a kind of anal compulsive super frum movement among Muslims that you need to pray exactly at the time when the sun is at its zenith, or exactly at the time of the morning prayer, and that is the actual time when the azan is done. That is, which comes from the word ozan, by the way. It's adhan. It's the calling to prayer. It's kind of the listening or speaking out, and then that's the time when the prayer period begins, where in order to be yotzei from your particular, you know, responsibility of praying for that, you could begin at that time, and then you have a lot of time afterwards. You have hours, or at least an hour or more afterwards when you can be yotzei too. But there is this kind of tendency now among many Muslims, including liberal Muslims in the West, that have been basically browbeaten by the Wahhabi types, the Salafi types, that say you really need to do it. You don't get your mitzvah points if you don't do it exactly at the right time. So when we have meetings with Jews and Muslims together, and prayer time is 8 o'clock, they say, I just want you to know, at 8 o'clock I'm going to do my prayers. We're going to do our prayers. So we have to stop the meeting at 8 o'clock so that we can do our prayers. And you have to accommodate us on this business, because this is religious requirement. Well, it's really not a religious requirement.
Either they can do 5 to 7 one time. If they don't have time during the day.
No. Not really. Yeah, you can do 2 of them, and not all of them, but some of them, and certain ones, yeah. But, yeah, so anyway, that becomes sort of a radicalization, if you will, of that, because you can really do it at any time during that expected period. So anyway, so high noon is the Dhuhr prayer, and then the Asr prayer is mid-afternoon, and then the sunset prayer is Maghrib. Yeah, that's Maghrib, right? And then the evening prayer is Isha, and then the only prayer that is required with a minyan is the Friday noon prayer. I think I wrote that probably in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, it begins with a sermon. The sermon comes first, and then the prayer. And you're supposed to hear the sermon and do the prayer.
How come Muslims don't have the equivalent of the Shabbat?
Sorry?
Why don't Muslims have something like the equivalent of the Shabbat? Full day of?
Well, they, I guess it follows the Christian view. Mm. Christians don't have Shabbat either. Mm. Right? So, no, they don't.
Christians have Sundays.
Yeah, but they couldn't work on Sundays. It's the Lord's Day. Calvinists maybe, but I don't think Catholics. Catholics can work.
They don't.
Not in this country.
It's like in Jerusalem, you know, Shabbos.
No.
Here in the.
Oh, but that's not the traditional. It's not a traditional Christian view, Orthodox Christianity.
No.
No, it's really not.
Is it Eastern Orthodox?
Yeah. I don't think
Russian
so.
Orthodox,
no? No. I don't think so, not at all. And in Islam, you need to break for the noon prayer on Friday. So the stores will close for that period of time, for a couple of hours, hour and a half or 2 hours. But other than that, they can stay open. You know, I think that's a sort of Calvinist leftover. I can't imagine. I don't think that's the case.
You want to turn the Sunday shops are open and they want to turn the store. Right?
Oh.
Yeah, but of course we live in a post country, so.
Well, you know, we have counties in America that have what they call blue laws, which it's illegal to open your store except if it's a pharmacy or food stores or whatever.
Hmm? You can't sell alcohol.
And you can't sell alcohol too. Because they read the Quranic verse,
here,
just don't pray when you're.
Here there were generally no shops open on Sunday until fairly recently, except Jewish shops.
Oh, and that's okay.
Because
so you'll know whether
you have to get a special permission to be open on Sunday. Mm. But now they have limited times and so on.
No, and not all over. Only if you can prove that you're a touristic area.
Yeah.
Oh.
And now also the yeah.
Albert Heijn is open on Sunday.
Yeah, that's new. That the supermarket is open now on Sunday too.
Yeah,
Some are.
Yeah.
Some are.
Yeah. And
the big ones.
Some are big ones and for a few hours. Anyway.
Okay. All right. So let's just take a look.
Asa.
The Asa prayer?
Mm-hmm. I mean, the word Asa.
Oh. The word Asa?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm just wondering what's related to 10.
Ten is Asher. Asher. So Asher. It is this, you know, Asa.
And so you have that.
Afar, maybe Atar. Atar, yeah. Afar.
Yeah,
I don't know. Ablutions. Ablutions?
Wudu.
Yeah, wudu. Yeah, right. So let's just look on page 3. Let's read the Daniel text. Because that's kind of, I actually never paid attention to this text, or maybe never even read it. I'm sure I've read it. It didn't make sense. It suddenly, it's really interesting. Well, this is in Aramaic. It's a little bit difficult to read. You want to read the English? When Daniel, son of anyone, want to do it?
Daniel.
When Daniel learned that the ban against worshipping any god but King Darius was put in writing, he went up to his house with its upper windows facing Jerusalem, and 3 times in the day knelt on his knees and prayed and gave thanks before his God, towards whom he always did previously. It's also from this verse that we have the requirement that the shul should have a window.
Yeah. And direction Jerusalem. Jerusalem.
Shul has to have a window.
No, they don't have to have it. They should have. It's better to have it.
In this verse? Yeah.
It is the connection between what happens here and the world. It's like the temple also. Windows the wrong way, so
right.
Light should go out. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The synagogue should have windows.
So it's interesting that this also says 3 times a day, but this doesn't seem to be, it's not the proof text for our praying 3 times a day.
Yeah.
And why not? Mm-hmm. I mean, why wouldn't it be?
It's not
better. Okay, it's not so long, but then we have windows. We need the windows.
No, but it's an indication of that this was custom at the time.
Already?
Yeah.
Already.
So it shows something about how early it was, depending on how early you placed Daniel.
Mm-hmm. And of course, this is the proof
the
text.
As example,
sorry?
It's better to have the Afot as
Yeah, although it's such a stretch. But yeah, they are a role model. Yeah.
That's never really stopped the rabbis at all.
But what they didn't...
According to the rabbis, Daniel lived at the temple of Bavon,
They didn't, they did, should have also gotten from this, though, that we should be on our knees praying.
Mm-hmm. Well, we did, I thought, we all always did.
It seems that...
Until the Muslims started, I was told that we stopped being
Mishtahabim.
Yeah.
I thought that was after the temple was down that we stopped doing that one. But I don't know. I don't know. I'm certainly no nazan on this history.
There are many Midrashim explanations. Each custom has at least 50
plausible
and probably correct explanations.
Right. Do you know that Abraham ben Harambam in Egypt in the 13th century tried to have developed the custom that you should take your shoes off before going in the Knesset? And the Karaites to this day take their shoes off.
As a Sufi, you should have.
Indian Jews do also.
Yeah. As do the Hindus.
I think he also tried to have them go flat on their...
He also tried that, and he also, didn't catch on.
So, this is that.
Now, Zakat will go to, I don't think you need to go over the three times a day for the Jewish prayer services, right?
No.
So, but notice, by the way, it is Metzaleh here, the term that's being used here is the same as Salah.
What do you mean in the...
In the Daniel text.
Yes.
And Salah Yusalli. So the active participle in Arabic is the same. So Mitsalli in Aramaic is Musalli in Arabic. So if you want to pray, Musalli, you Musalli. If it's the active participle. Salah. Okay, so required almsgiving, zakat, or zakat, probably from zechut, or related to the term zechut, and a sadaqa. Now, I want to talk about the word sadaqa for a moment. Do you know how we're supposed to pronounce the word sadaqa? Sadaqa? Sudoki. Sudoki.
Sudoku.
Sudoku. So this, the tzadi, the reason that we pronounce the tzadi like a tzif sound is because the actual sound for this letter doesn't occur in any European languages. It's a Semitic, old Semitic sound, and since European Jews couldn't reproduce it, lost the ability to reproduce it, it fell out and became pronounced incorrectly. Same with the kuf. The kuf is not a K, ka sound, but it's a ka sound. Ka. So there is a whole category of letters in Hebrew that find an equivalent in Arabic, and those are letters that when you open up your mouth really fully, and it's worth actually trying it because it's interesting. So we have tet and taf, right? Mm-hmm. Clearly, they cannot have been the same sounds at one point because they're two different symbols for them. So one must be one and one is the other. So ta, we assume, was ta, as we know. And tet was ta, ta. So if you open up your mouth really wide and solid and then say ta, ta, ta. So te, that's ta, and tet is ta. In all of these sounds, by the way, it's easier to pronounce the sound when you have an A vowel than when you have an E vowel. Mm-hmm. Same with the gutturals. Which is why in Hebrew, because Hebrew speakers were lazy, there is one of the common exceptions to the way verbs work. So you don't say, you should say, ani shomer, because you say ein, right? Ein. So say ayin. Ayin. Pretend the doctor has the tongue depressor on you and you're making you say ah. That's the ayin sound. Ah. Very full open mouth. Ah. and you're in the back. So you can say ah. Now try to say a. It's much more difficult to say a. So instead of saying shomea, which is what we should be saying, it's easier to say shomea. Mm-hmm. So even if you're pronouncing the ayin, which we've lost basically, we say shomea. Mm-hmm. It's almost s shomea with a ya instead of an ah. Shomea, it's easier. And sholeh shouldn't be sholeah, should be sholeh. And those guttural letters are all consistent because the ah sound is easier to pronounce. So this makes it easier to learn grammar because grammar, is nobody just created this exception to be exceptional. It's because there's some kind of organic reason why these things occur, and that's one reason. So all of these sounds are easier when they're pronounced with an ah sound, and they tend, especially those like taf and ut sound, it's easier when you have your mouth really open. So the sabi is really, we have sin and we have sadi. So the sadi is a sa. I don't know. I don't know which one. It might have been shin, samech, and sadi. And I'm not sure about that piece of it. But I do know that the sadi is supposed to be sa. So say sa. Sa. So now put it all together and it's siddaqah. Siddaqah. And if you talk to an Arabic-speaking Jew, a Jew from Iraq, then he or she will probably say siddaqah. But not the Persians, not the Iranians, because they can't say the qa. So Iranian Muslims can't say the qa. They say Qur'an. Have you ever heard them say it?
Qur'an.
They can't say the qa. They go qa. They get close, but they can't quite get there. They say the Qur'an.
The Greek Jews who can't say the shin, Greek Jews who can't say the shin. Sabbat Salam.
Yes, Shabbat Shalom. And also the Greeks have a hard time with the hey. And as Russian speakers too, right?
Hey. Like
there's all these different things.
Like English with the chet, yes.
Yeah, right. With the what? Yeah. So the word in Arabic for tzedaka is sadaqa. And the word in Hebrew for tzedaka is sadaqa. So in the Hebrew, tends to want to stress the penultimate syllable, the next to the last. I'm sorry, the ultimate syllable, the last syllable. And Arabic likes to stress the next to the last syllable. So, and usually, but in this, it's sadaqa, sadaqa, sadaqa. Okay, so may I have a read for the first one? The cow.
They ask you what they should contribute. Say, the good you have contributed is for parents, relatives, orphans, the poor, and the wayfarer. God knows whatever good you do.
All right.
That's not an answer. Anything you do.
What
they should contribute.
They should ask you who they should contribute to.
But I'm translating it like literally. It is what they ask you, what you should be. The word isn't really exactly contributed. What you should be paying as your responsibility, something like that. Well, say
what?
Because it's mada.
The answer is more to whom you should pay it.
Yes, right. So the answer is not exactly the answer to the question.
Well, the answer is you contribute by your deeds. Need not per se be in money. It can also be
for parents, relatives, orphans, the poor, and the wayfarer.
So what's the verb in the Dutch? What do you have in the translation there for contributor pay?
Basically the same. It says, "Laat het goede dat jullie als bijdragen geven zijn voor de ouders en verwanten in wezen die behoefte van hen die onderweg is."
What is
so let the good that you contribute be for sort of this is the business relation of what he gives.
What does our friend Daoud say? What does Daoud say?
It's
anfaka.
I'm just thinking. In,
they will ask you. Yeah. Says they will ask you about almsgiving. Say, whatever you bestow in charity must go to parents and to kinfolk, to the orphan and to the destitute and to the traveler in need. God is aware of whatever good you do.
So he's interpreting in money. I was thinking tzedakah may have something to do with righteous behavior also.
Mm-hmm.
It does not necessarily have to be money.
Yeah, just
do
don't put a Jewish spin on it, because it may not be. Just
no,
because
no,
the Jewish, yeah, tzedakah in the Jewish way, but it might not be that. Just because the word is a Semitic cognate doesn't mean that the meaning is the same.
No.
It would be related, yeah.
Just
think it means translated. Zij vragen jullie naar wat zij uit moeten geven. Zeg, hoeveel rijkdom jullie ook uitgeven, het is voor de ouders en de naaste familie en de wezen, de behoeftige en de reiziger. En welk goed jullie ook doen, Allah is er werkelijk de weter van. Jeroen Rietberg.
Okay. Somebody translated the Muhammad Ali.
Ahmadiyya. It's from the Ahmadiyya.
Ahmadiyya.
So whatever you spend is...
However much you spend, you must know that it's for
those things. Okay.
Ahmadiyya, so it's not kosher.
Okay, so let's go to the next one. So there's the term, because we don't have zakat in this word, in this verse. So let's do the next one. About reader.
So zakat are for the poor and the needy, the workers who administer them, and those whose heart are to be won over, for ransom of slaves, relief of debtors, for the path of God and the wayfarer, the duty imposed by God, for God is known and wise.
But it's never mentioned how much you're supposed to give, which part you give, to just to whom, whatever,
right.
Whatever
but
you give is okay.
That's also not in Tanakh. It's also worked out in Tanakh.
That's
worked
out later, yeah.
But it says God is known.
Huh?
God is known.
God knows what's going on.
Yeah.
You can't cheat.
Big brother's watching.
Yeah.
It's also for those who tithe or to be one of them.
For those who...
Yeah.
It's a tool for conversion.
Probably. Keep in mind, though, this was community building in those days. It wasn't going out and missionizing.
Mm-hmm.
It was trying to convince the local people that this is a good community where people are sharing their wealth and not hoarding, and as was, at least in theory, was happening around in Mecca at the time. I just want to see the verse number. This is verse 9. So that's considered a late, usually, I mean, chapter 9. That's usually considered a very late chapter. But I question all of these assumptions about
late,
whether it's early and late, because that is all, it ends up being very politicized. You know why it was politicized? Because the later revelations were assumed to take precedence over the earlier revelations. So they would abrogate the earlier revelations. So if you can determine that the later revelations are the revelations that you like, then those are the important revelations. And so there was a lot of politicizing of trying to determine the chronology of revelations.
But it was also because they were conflicting.
And they were also, because they were conflicting, yeah.
Well, that's the main reason.
One could in theory develop a different theory entirely. One could develop a different view and just say that, you know, God's wisdom is deep and great, and we should have learn to live with contradiction, and we don't have all, you know, there are all kinds of ways to do it, but that's a pretty lot to assume from anybody. Okay, can we move on to the next?
I'm just trying to find within my Quran the completely different
order.
Is that possible?
This is chapter 9, verse 60. Let me see, I can maybe look at it in the Arabic. is interesting. It's not anywhere near there, it looks like.
No.
This is a different... Maybe I've got it wrong. Oh, this is chapter 2. Right? It's chapter 9. Yeah, well, it's chapter 9, I think we are. Right? Yeah. Chapter 9. Let's see if it's...
So we go back to 2. Oh,
it's not there either. It's 60?
Yeah.
2, 9, 60. Oh, no, I'm at 10. 9. What? I don't get it. I don't understand. What does this say?
Beard.
Beard? Veil?
Veil is part.
Oh, part 10. Where do you get the chapter numbers? What's H?
The chapter.
Oh, I see. Okay. I understand what that is.
It's
in
the
In that Sodom, yeah, that's right.
Having a non-Jewish Bible, you can't find anything.
There's a lot of criticism for Muslims when this edition.
Sorry?
When this edition was published, there was a lot of criticism among Dutch Muslims about this.
About the Did they say that it was a bad translation?
Yeah.
Oh. Okay. I don't know. I don't know. It could have been sour grapes because the Ahmadiyya, in terms of their actual Islamic practice, are a pretty straight mainline Muslims. But they're not very into jihad. They're really not into jihad. But they're pretty straight man, except they have another prophet. That's what Ibn Balbi said. Anyway, so how was that translation?
Charity, they're just for the needy and for the ones... liefdadigheid is er slechts voor de armen en de behoeftigen en voor degenen aangesteld om het uit te delen. En degenen van wie de harten tot de waarheid worden bekeerd. En voor het verkrijgen van gevangenen en voor degenen die een schuld hebben. En langs Allah's weg en voor de reiziger een bevel van Allah. En Allah is wetend, wijs.
Bijna hetzelfde. Het is anders te zijn.
Almost.
So let's do Surah 2, back to the cow. And here we have the terms that Kathy used.
Where do the names of the surahs come from?
Some noteworthy image that's found in the surah that people use just to hook the name on them. That was the other reason. And some of them, like the one we just read, Tawbah, is whatever it is, repentance. It's also called... I think it's also called Banu Israel because it does relate to the Banu Israel as well. So some people call it one, some people call it the other. So can we do Surah 2?
Those who believe the wicked words establish prayers and give zakah. Their reward is with their Lord. No fear shall come upon them, neither shall they grieve.
Yeah, that's an idiom that's used, and it's exactly la khawfu alayhim wa lahum yahzanun. That's also the idiom that's used for Jews and Christians and Sabaeans, whoever believes in God in the last day and does righteous acts. They shall not fear, neither shall they grieve. So it's the same idiom that's used for that, which is really interesting. I
don't get what you're saying.
This idiom, no fear shall come upon them, neither shall they grieve. That basically means you get olam haba.
Yeah.
And in this context, the people who get olam haba are those who believe, ma'aminim, and they do good works, and they establish prayers, and they give zakat. They get olam haba. It doesn't say Muslims, doesn't say Jews, doesn't say Christians, but the presumption is that this is for the believers that are following Muhammad. In another text, there is a reference specifically directed toward Jews and Christians and another community of people called Sabaeans. We're not sure who they are. And then it says, those Jews, Christians, and Sabaeans who believe in God and do good works and believe in the day of judgment, they don't have anything to fear, neither shall they grieve. It's the same idiom. You have to be a believer.
Yeah,
a mu'min.
Yeah. No, but if you look at Hebrew text referring to tzedakah, it doesn't talk about believing. It's talking about what you have to do. It's talking more about the deeds. And here it does combine the belief.
I see, believing and doing deeds.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But that's right. That's for the end reward. But that's not. You can still give zakah without believing.
But maybe in Judaism, that you believe is an axiom. It's given, it's not talked about.
Why is it given?
Right.
Yeah.
I'm always questioning, how can you force people to believe? So they require to believe, but I mean... No, I know that, but that's also here. Those who believe and do good works. So what about people who don't believe and do good works?
See, by definition, if they do things that appear to be good, they don't believe, they really, in essence, are not good.
Yeah, but it's
not okay. Look, I don't know what believe means. Right. I really don't know what believe means. The root, amana, means to be secure. That's really what it means. So it might mean the people who... I don't know. I'm only guessing, right? There's such a range of meaning. Ne'eman. Amen. You know, in modern Arabic, the word for insurance is ta'amin, an insurance policy. So it might mean those people who are steadfast. It doesn't have that sense of faith meaning. You know, the ya'amin, there's a statement about Abraham. The Yamin Badunai the Yahshaveh Hu Lo Tzedakah. Right? And he, what? Does that mean that he had faith in God? Or does it mean that he was steadfast with God or trusting in God? And that was considered to him Tzedakah. I don't know what Tzedakah means either, really.
In Dutch, I use the term not faith, but it's geloof. Godvertrouwen.
Which means what?
Trust. Which means somehow you rely on.
No, I know. I know that, but I'm always looking at the way those who believe.
Yeah.
Well, it depends on how you translate it, because it's again the same thing. You translate it with geloof of met vertrouwen.
Yeah, but I'm not. Still, then it is a mindset, and that's what you ask about it.
Yes.
Yeah.
How do you force people to
you
have
don't like soup. I mean, you have to like the soup. Well, I don't like the soup. You have to believe. Well, I don't believe.
Right.
So no, but trust isn't that you can measure in behavior.
But trust is your
belief. You can't.
No, but trust in God is still something.
I didn't say trust in God.
Yes, you did. Godvertrouwen.
No.
I'm sorry.
That's in the Dutch, not in English.
Yeah, no.
Okay, so I want to complicate this a little bit more.
Yes,
you know?
Trust
so
something.
In my native language, I view as a Christianized language.
Yes.
I'm sure Dutch is the same way.
Yes.
So the term belief already has undertones of faith in the saving power of Christ. Belief is really belief in the Christian notion of God. So whenever I use that term, I have some issues with it. But that's the term that's used. I mean, that is the term. That is how this word is translated. But belief can mean trust. It doesn't have to mean believing in the saving power of Christ. It doesn't have to have that faith belief in a kind of Christian context. But frankly, it's impossible to get around it. Because it's my language, and I'm always struggling at some level with the assumptions that are associated with the word. So, but emunah and amen, and all these words that come from that root, don't really mean belief in the saving power of Christ. And even that kind of faith, not necessarily, but we can't really recapture it because it's so deeply embedded in my being, I can't kind of, at some level, it's hard for me to get beyond it. So.
But I mean...
You don't buy that?
No, I have a different question.
You have a different question, okay.
But when... So you say that when this is translated, it's translated by people who are also using a Christianized language.
Anybody whose native language is English or whose native language is Dutch
right.
is Christianized.
So, but how do Muslims then, is there any, how do Muslims then have the experience of the word?
I don't know, but if you're an Arabic speaker.
Yeah.
And that's your native language.
Then it's a different.
Then
sort
it might
of
be.
Di-
it
different
might be
shade.
Different. Yeah, it might be different.
And there is not this compulsive power to do a certain mind.
Oh, I'm sure there is in some communities. Yes, and in some communities, no. Not. I don't. You know, always keep in mind that Islam is just as variegated as Judaism, probably
right.
more so because there are more people.
Right.
So. We have a tendency, because we don't really know the community as a whole, that we sort of look at it as monolithic. That's the way non-Jews tend to look at Judaism, too. And Jews, they're all, the Jews say this and the Jews do that. And, of course, that's, we know better. But, you know, and we, of course, do the same thing, because everybody does. Right. We want to try to get beyond it as best we can, realizing that it's a tendency.
Did you mention the Sabians?
Yes.
You know about?
Some people have suggested that that was a some religious community in South Arabia. I don't know. The bottom line is we aren't. There's no agreement among the scholars as to who the Sabaeans are. Sabbateans, or who knows what. Okay. So we don't have to do the Deuteronomy texts, right? These are something that's somewhat parallel in some way. Now let's go to page 5. So we have the same issue with the word for fasting. How do you say fasting in proper Hebrew?
Som.
Som. Not som. Please, don't be so vuzvuzi, Ashkenazim, and all that. Som. Now, the word in Arabic is saum. Saum. It's the same word, right? Siyam or saum, but mostly saum. Okay. Now, so, may I have a reader for Surah 2? Oh, by the way, I always say, by the way, don't I? I say that a lot. The rules about living your life as a Muslim tend to be in the early surahs, like Surah 2. You'll get a lot of information from Surah 2. The parts of the Quran that deal with the kind of prophecies and the mantic poetry, they tend to be in the end of the Quran. So the end of the Quran is assumed to be more early than the beginning of the Quran, which tends to be soon to be more late in the actual chronology of Revelation. But again, those questions are not, you know, it's not clear. Okay, so we have a reader. Ira, would you take that?
Believers.
Oh, great. Yes, good.
Fasting is commanded for you, even as it was commanded for those before you, so that you be pious. Fast a certain number of days. But if any of you be sick or in a journey, then a number of other days. Those who are in a position to fast may redeem the duty by feeding a poor individual. But if one does good voluntarily, it is better for him. And it is better for you to fast if you have knowledge. The month of Ramadan, in which the Quran was sent down as guidance for the people, and as clarity of guidance and for God.
Yeah.
So whoever of you is present during the month, let him fast it. But if anyone is sick or on a journey, let the person fast the number of other days. God intends to make it easy for you and does not. full number of days, and that you may magnify God for your guidance, that you will be thankful.
It's a lot of stuff here. Yeah.
There is a sense in Muslim commentary that we have for the Torah, but there isn't a petition. This is a reason for it.
Yes. So the first verse looks like it's saying something like, we are following in the footsteps of the previous monotheists. They fast, we fast. Mm-hmm. So be pious and make sure you do it. And then fast, but if you're sick or you're on a journey, don't fast. Some other time.
And is pregnancy seen as a sickness?
No, it's just pregnancy. Okay. It's not healthy to be fasting if you're pregnant, so don't fast.
Also having your
period. Yeah, especially if you're ill, mm-hmm. you can do that, but you have to make it up.
Yeah.
So if you're pregnant, you know, so which means that after you're pregnant, you have to still do it?
Yeah, in theory, yes.
In theory.
Yeah, but people aren't necessarily watching.
It's between you, except for the baby.
And it's redemption, by the way. It's the same word as fada, pode, is used there. Mm-hmm. And when it has the needy people here, where it says that.
Yeah.
You know what they're called? They're called miskin.
Oh, really?
Yeah, miskin.
Okay. Miskin. Yeah.
Miskin. It's great, isn't it? So, where was I going? Oh, I was once in Amman in Jordan during Ramadan, and I had to fly out on Ramadan, and I was really kind of nervous being on the airplane, because I thought this is going to be really embarrassing. I'm going to be the only one on this plane eating, right? Mm-hmm. And then we sat down, and everybody was served lunch, and everybody ate. All these, you know, women, covered women, men, very traditional looking men. Everybody was eating during Ramadan in the middle of the day, and I didn't realize that it was the traveling. I hadn't learned that yet, and I was shocked. I just couldn't believe that people were, you know, eating on Ramadan. Well, now I know why.
So are people traveling on Ramadan on purpose?
Yeah.
Especially in summertime.
Cruise.
Month of August this year is pretty
Ramadan,
much the full
Ramadan
month.
Ramadan cruise?
Yeah. That's a great idea. Wow, that is so good. Yes.
$5 million
here.
There you go.
Okay. And Furqan. What is Furqan?
Guidance and Furqan. I don't know that word.
So the on at the end of the word is also a non-Arabic morphological form. On, long on, like Rabbanan, Rabbaniyun, Rabban, Furqan.
It's an instruction?
Exactly. Yikum Furqan.
Furqan is instruction? No.
Furqan is
redemption.
Yeah.
Redemption, okay.
Yeah. And so Arabic, this probably, now it's a reference usually to the Quran. Sometimes it'll, in Furqan, is because the Quran is a redemptive revelation, but they don't have that meaning in Furqan. So in Arabic, in classical Arabic, farraka means to distinguish between or to divide, like lefarek. Lefarek is to right, to disconnect or something. Mm-hmm. So farraka, so Furqan is sort of understood by most Muslims as the distinguishing right from wrong. The Furqan is another word for the Quran, which distinguishes right from wrong. Probably not. It probably really means the redemptive revelation. And that's really interesting, because you see how that meaning probably came in also as a religious term from Syriac or from Aramaic. Yeah. And then the other item here that I wanted to point out to you is God intends to make it easy for you and does not want to make it difficult for you.
Well, that's not true.
But that's halachot in Islam. And the Quran stakes out the position that it is halacha, sharia, but not to the extreme that Judaism is. So God wants you to do the right thing, and you have to obey the divine law because it's required of you, because it will make you a better person. But God doesn't want to make you do crazy things like not eat veal parmesan or, you know,
6 hours.
Right, or whatever. Yeah, you don't, or not use those dishes or whatever. That's not what God really wants. God wants a consciousness raising and not the anal compulsive aspect of sort of the subtext halakha.
But that's also like it is not very far or far. It's not there's this not also
yes.
Which says that
yeah
not to
it's
difficult.
Not,
yeah,
not,
yeah
right.
It's not impossible to
yeah.
do it.
Yeah. Well, that's the biblical view, not the rabbinic view.
No.
Yes.
Okay. But.
But you have to know it belongs to the Chavarim and who doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah, the Karaites were worse. And they got more anal compulsive about it.
Yes, of course. Well, it's all very obsessive.
Who?
It's to be very obsessive.
Oh, yeah.
That's what they need. The psychological tests.
Uh-huh. If
they were
compared
with the ultra-orthodox
crowd,
if you
are
natural.
Who's more?
If the Karaites would be compared to...
Yeah, probably not. Yeah, probably not. But they were doing it seems, to stake out a position of piety, saying the rabbis weren't really pious, and they didn't really understand the real meaning. You know, if it says, Lotivaer, what does it say? What is it? The word is Levaer.
To light
fires. Yeah, no, to burn, to have fires
burn. Yeah, to have fires
burn.
Yeah.
Right,
yes.
And that seems to be the meaning.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's not that you should light the candles before Shabbat and then keep them on.
Not have them on.
Fire. You shouldn't have them on at all during Shabbat. That's the more. That's right. Yeah, so that's more.
And they keep the text, the rabbis don't.
What? Although they do have some problems.
Yes, of course they have problems. Especially in the winter in Russia.
Yeah. Okay, and the last...
you're watching the new moon, but what do you do when you're in New York and you have to watch the new moon in Paris? It's sort of
problem.
No.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
You go in to the camera and the closet.
Mm-hmm. You just twist it up. But then
yes.
Okay, so the last of them is Hag. You know how to say Hajj in Egyptian Arabic is Hag. Yeah, because they pronounce the Jim like G. They say the proper way to say camel in Arabic is Jama. But in Egypt they say Gama. It's just like in Hebrew, Gama, right? So the Jim and the Gimel are the same letter. Mm-hmm. So Hajj is Hag. So you can say, next time you can say Hajj Sameach. Try that. See how that goes.
You tried in Holland, but it's
yeah, it's a head. Okay, so let's learn how to say the head. We did the third and the half. Head, head, not head. That head is wrong.
It's a lingual head.
Half is ch. But head, ha, ha. So say. When I try to get people to say it, say you have a friend that's very far away and you want to say, hey, hello, say it, try say it, just say it, yell it,
hey.
You have a tendency to,
ha.
You're closing in the very back of your mouth and you're making it, it's a hey, but with a constricted hey, ha, ha,
ha,
you've got it, yeah. No, not ch, not in the back of your. You don't use your tongue. If you say ch, you've got your tongue. The heel of your tongue is working. Don't work your tongue. Your tongue is at the bottom of your mouth. Ha, ha, try it. Larry, try it. Let's hear it. Get those abs moving there. Ha. See, if you're laughing at it, it'll work too. You get really strong.
Can you do quiet conducting?
Ha.
Ha.
Ha. Head. Chas v'halila. Chas v'shalom. Chas v'halila. Hen v'hesed v'rachamim. Yeah, and so the word, you know, Yitzhak in Hebrew should be pronounced Yishak. And that's how it's pronounced in Arabic. Yishak. 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 Okay, enough of that. That's fun, right? You got a little exercise? Now we'll try to exercise our brain a little bit. All right, so that's Hajj. Okay, may I have a reader?
They ask about new moons, saying they are fixed times for the people on the pilgrimage. Perform the Hajj and the Umrah to God. But if you're prevented, then send such sacrificial gifts as may be convenient. But do not shave your heads until the gift has reached its place. If anyone of you is sick or suffering from an injury to the head, then a compensation by way of fasting or almsgiving requires observance. Hajj is during the known months, so whoever undertakes the Hajj as a duty, then let there be no lewdness, no vice, and no wrangling during the Hajj. God knows the good you do. Take provision, but the best provision is piety. Show piety towards me, O you of insight.
What has the shaving of the hair to do with it?
Very old pre-Islamic Arabian tradition of probably a statement that you did your duty and you come home and everybody sees that your head is shaved. Not for women, for men only. Right. So for to this day, men shave during the Hajj. And you know when somebody's Haji because they come home and they don't have any hair. They still have their beard, but they want to... You must be a Haji. So that's part of the
he's a holy man.
Yeah. And the word here, so let's think about the word haram for a moment. Mm-hmm. Okay, so haram means, that's the word for, it's the opposite of halal, right? Mm-hmm. Halal means it's acceptable. Mm-hmm. Haram means it's forbidden. Haram has a really interesting range of meaning. It's also a harem, where the women are, because it's haram to be there if you're not, okay, you know, acceptable. And a haram is also a sacred area in which certain kinds of behaviors are forbidden, like fighting or killing animals or uprooting trees. This is all nature. So a sacred site like the area around Mecca that is in the haram area is an area that you have to be certain behaviors. You cannot ever hunt in the area that's designated as haram. So haram has a sense of sanctity and it has a sense of forbiddenness to it. And when you take on the vow of doing the Hajj, when you're outside of the sacred area, you do what is called ihram. You take on this notion of sanctity, which is using the same term of haram. So it's ihram. And in that, you wear different clothing. The men all wear a seamless, basically a blanket of just white cloth. And it's wrapped around, like a sari kind of thing for men, simple thing. And nobody can wear clothing that's not that. Luckily, the weather's always so miserable, you don't get too cold there. Couldn't do that in Holland if you're going to make pilgrimage to, you know, to Rotterdam or something. So, and women also wear a certain kind of plain clothing. You don't wear fancy clothes, but you don't wear this kind because you have a lot of skin showing. And you're not supposed to show skin if you're a woman. The Muslim, you actually shouldn't show skin if you're a man either. Skin is bad, basically. So you take on this vow called ihram, and then you are in a state of ihram, and the garments that you are called ihram. And there's these white garments. And it's really kind of nice. And there's something interesting about the Hajj, and that is that women and men are exactly equal. Women don't, there's no Ezrat Nashim. Women aren't separated. Women and men do all the prayers together. They do the circumambulation of the Kaaba. They do all the various pieces of the Hajj are completely equal between men and women. And that's the only time in the kind of prayer world when that's the way it is. So that's the Hajj. And the rules, all the rituals of the Hajj seem to have come from pre-Islamic tradition. And these were various activities that were associated with polytheistic practices of Mecca during that period of time. And those very practices were reinterpreted to be statements of monotheism. So, for example, remember, David, you said, you asked the question about when he reached the age of running or adulthood. The term is sa'a. And there is, in the Hajj ritual, on a certain day, you're supposed to do the sa'a. It's the running ritual. And you run between, you literally run, you sort of jog or barely run. No, not Tarafat, between Safa and Marwa. Have you heard those terms, Safa and Marwa? These are the two hills, and there were two idols. There was an idol on Safa and an idol on Marwa in the pre-Islamic period, and you went between them and you did some kind of ritual that has been lost, right? But you did some kind of action between them. But the ritual of the Safa today is considered the running that Hagar did trying to find water for Ishmael when he was dying in the desert. She went up to one hill to look for water, look all around, and she didn't see it, so she saw another hill. She ran up to the other hill to look all around, and then she didn't see it. She got into a panic, so she went up to the first hill, and she did it 7 times, which is unlikely if you were really in that strait. It was more likely it was simply a repetition of an old tradition. But on the 7th time, then God revealed the well and the spring that was the spring of the sacred well in Mecca. So that's how an old tradition became sort of reinterpreted into a new tradition. And there's an Arafat is where you that's throwing at the devils, throwing at the stones. Arafat is called the Wukuf, where you stand and the sun rises. This is another really weird old ritual where you stand for like 12 hours and literally millions of people stand on this mountain called Arafat and in the valley below, and they just stand for hours as the sun comes up. And it's apparently a very, very moving moment. It's got to be celestial gods and goddesses and spirits. It's got to be very weird and probably really cool. But No, I haven't done it. I'm nervous about it. I'd love to. I mean, plenty of adventurers have done it. You know, we're not Muslim. But
dress in the burqa.
No.
I have to do ihram like everybody else.
Well, you can dress in the burqa. You don't have to reserve the dirhat there and
then. Oh, yeah, I guess I could. But no, but the women don't wear burqas.
No,
they don't wear burqas. They're open.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I'm not sure why.
Even the women that you are used to wearing burqas.
You know, now that you ask me that, I'm not sure, but I don't remember ever seeing a woman with a burqa. I don't think you do. I think I remember people telling me that you don't wear a burqa, even if you're used to wearing a burqa.
That's interesting.
Yeah, a lot of the traditions have kind of thrown, are really kind of changed up a little bit on that, especially the women on the women's restrictions. So the tradition is that you're obligated by Islamic law to make the pilgrimage once in your life, at least, but you are prevented from doing so if doing that would bring hardship on your family because of the economic cost. It's forbidden to take a loan in order to go on Hajj. You have to have all your debts paid. You have to be in good shape, partly because very often people died on the way or on the way back. And so you had to make sure everything was in order. And if you die when you're on Hajj, you immediately get a ticket right to heaven. You become a shaheed, a martyr. And also, if you die in childbirth, you're immediately a shaheeda.
Really?
You're a martyr, and you immediately go to heaven.
The mother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there are... I was just wondering why you...
That would be easy. That would be easy.
they would take the easy way out.
That would be a tough one, yeah. So that's the Hajj. And the other thing is that there are traditions where the traditions in the Midrashic literature, the equivalent of Midrash, where Abraham visits Ishmael and they build the Kaaba. Remember, we talked about that yesterday. And then after that, Abraham then calls the call to the Hajj. And that's a citation right out of the Quran, where God says to Abraham, make a call to the Hajj. And I didn't include that text here. But he calls everyone, so the whole world is obligated, by the call to Abraham to make a Hajj. And then the commentaries say, and everybody heard it. People alive, people not alive, Atem Yitzavim Hayom, right? And, yeah.
If in the Quran it says Abraham was neither a Jew nor a Christian, he was a Muslim, and he called out for everybody to go on the Hajj, why couldn't Jews or Christians or anybody go on Hajj?
Oh, that's a good question. The Quran doesn't say that Jews and Christians can't go on the Hajj.
But in practice,
yeah, in practice
you cannot, because the moment that you would go in Saudi Arabia, you would be defiling the soil.
Yeah, that came later. It came later. Exactly when people have worked on it, I don't remember. There's a tradition that Umar ibn al-Khattab, who was the second caliph, kicked the Jews out of Arabia. He was the guy who did that. But they still lived in Yemen, in South Arabia, they did, but not in the Hijaz area of that sacred area.
Because then, I mean, did they even call everybody to
It makes sense. There is a sense of sanctity. It's a little bit like, the temple in Jerusalem, too.
Where everybody could come also.
No. Non-Jews were forbidden from coming. They would be killed if they went beyond that outer area. You could go into the...
Except Hashim, they could come.
Non-Jews couldn't get... There was a low wall that Josephus writes about.
Yeah.
And, in fact, the sign in Greek and in Hebrew, one of those signs has been located in an archaeological dig in the temple. And it says in Greek and in Hebrew, it says, if you go beyond this point, you've just taken your own life. To Goyim, it says. And so only Israelites could go beyond that point. But then, beyond that point, women could go to a certain location, but they couldn't go any further. But men could go further. And then only Leviim could go beyond that point. Men couldn't go. And then, of course, only the Kohen Gadol could go into the Kodesh.
Is the temple area also counted as a Haram?
Today?
Yes.
The Temple Mount is called the Haram Rashi, Sharif,
yeah.
the noble sanctuary. Yeah. So it is Haram. But it doesn't mean that non-Muslims can't go there. Because maybe they don't have control. But I'm sure there's no question whatsoever that there would be Muslims that say, if they had control of that, that they would never allow non-Muslims to go in because it's a sacred site for Muslims. But I don't think that's necessary. Islam.
Okay.
I think it's an opinion. It would be a problem. It definitely would be a problem. Yeah. So, want to take a break?
Yes.
We got through the five pillars.
Again?